Ladies and gentlemen,
we are coming to the interpretation of that which assumes the name in Buddhism for three marks or signs of the universe. And that is why I asked you to read that, to read these 10 pages where one interpretation is given by Edward Conza, I think one of the most splendid interpretations. You know, the thing is, well, the three marks are the impermanence of all that there is, the of all that there is, and the egolessness of all that there is. I think that word is a bit unusual in English or in American English. Can it be understood? Egolessness. It can, yes. Yes. In English scholarship, they usually say I-lessness, but I think it would be better to put it as ego-lessness. And, you know, indeed, only at the first sight, it seems that it's very easy to comprehend. Impermanence. Impermanence. In European philosophy, in ancient Greek tradition, the first philosopher who offered that postulate of impermanence was who? Heraclitus, yes. Or in your parlance, Heraclitus, yes. Good. Heraclitus. Who said what? Louder, please, to the whole class.
You can't stop in the same river twice.
Yes. Now, let us try to render it into the language of Buddhist philosophy. Try, instead of you cannot step twice into the same water or the same river, but in the language of the Buddhist philosophy, it will be
all things are impermanent.
As an example. No. What is
it? Say, you are different when you step in that.
Splendid, my friend. You are not the same. Not only river is not the same, that you are not the same. You got it, my lady? Yes? A clever chap, isn't it? Your neighbor, yes? Yes. Even that needs a further explanation, ladies and gentlemen. Even that, however elementary, is not that simple. Because in its first reading, it may sound, in terms of, shall we say, philosophy of nature, yes. The river changes. While in its second Buddhist reinterpretation, it will be you changing the term. That is that who is stepping in the river. And that is when a totally new philosophical question arises. Try to deal with my rather dubious, though insignificant, semantic changes. I would say Who is he who steps in Heraclitus, yes, river, yes? Who is he or she? Or it would be more exactly to ask, who, yet not who, forget about who. We are in Buddhism. There is no who, my lady, in Buddhism. Instead of who, we have to use what. What? What is that which cannot step in the same river? And in the Buddhist philosophy, that what is changing all the time as the river is changing. But I do not want to disappoint you, but Heraclitus was no Buddhist at all. Oh, by the way, there are some rather dubious hypotheses that he was acquainted with Buddhist philosophy. Don't forget about one utterly interesting fact that, speaking historically, all of them lived what? At absolutely the same time. Pre-Socratics, Socrates, Plato, Buddha, and the first great exponents of the Buddhist philosophical schools, they lived, all of them, in the space between what?
Fifth century.
Sorry?
Fifth century.
Between the fifths, between the fifths, shall we say, and the end of the fourth century BC. Isn't that interesting? Who was the first philosopher who paid attention to that historical fact? Oh, no, God Almighty. Of course Hegel. Not. Sorry, no. Hegel would have never given a damn about Indian philosophy. He called it, oh, well, it is fantasy piled. Fantasies piled upon fantasies. Yes.
I wish I had a little philosopher dice.
Sorry?
I wish I had philosopher dice. I wish I had philosopher dice.
Louder, please.
I wish I had philosopher dice. The names of the philosophers on the dice, so I could just roll them and guess.
You know, it was a German philosopher.
Nietzsche.
Karl Jaspers. You know him? Yes. I do not know Karl Jaspers, but you do, yes? No? But you undoubtedly do. A little bit, yes. Because, you know, Karl Jaspers, he was not the greatest philosopher, but he was an absolutely remarkable person. And it was him who said at the very beginning of the Nazi regime in general, when he was asked by his friends whether he was for or against Hitler. Ask me about that, because Nazism for me does not exist. There is no such an entity as Nazism. Don't ask me about emptiness. And to emptiness I am absolutely professor. Still, he was a very outstanding professor of what? Do you remember? Psychiatry. He was a great psychiatrist. At the same time, professor, of what can you explain to us what you meant when you said that Nazi regime did not exist? Well, tell us. Because we have to write a report, yes. All secret services, their main duty is what? To write reports, yes. as you know, probably, yes, in the world, yes. It's the most report-writing organization, Secret Service, in any country, yes. Carl Jaspers looked at them and said, "Oh, my friends, speaking simply, it means that now you do not exist." Make it more comprehensible, yes. To which they retorted, "We hope, Professor, that in the nearest future you will change your opinion about our existence, and it will be when we shall put you and your wife to concentration camp." Yes. They were truthful chaps, yes. And Jaspers said, "I will be welcoming such development of events." He was absolutely unimaginable. He was absolutely fearless. So it was Jaspers' idea that somewhere, it was a historical digression. Jaspers' idea was that somewhere between the 5th and the end of the 4th century BC, there was a kind of strange series of events in various countries, in various socio-cultural and political conditions, at more or less the same time. There existed several philosophers radically different from the thinking of their countries, cultures, and milieus, yes.
Do you know the name of the work or the works in which he explores? Do you know the name of the work or works in which he explores that idea?
Oh, he repeats it, well, practically everywhere. Practically everywhere. It was, as it were, his commonest ideas.
If you were to suggest 30 pages where he says something like that?
You know, I cannot. I have a very, very bad memory. But definitely one book of his must be excluded, Introduction to Psychology, because it was written definitely before he said that. Well, but you know, by the way, he was a person with an absolute neglect of established thinking, of established standards of thinking. He was probably, as a thinker, one of the bravest. Didn't give a damn about whether it will be accepted or not. He was the bravest of... Probably after him there was another philosopher, Albert Camus, by the way, and it was in a more Buddhistic way. It was the same Carl Jaspers who said, before starting your fight against Nazism, against fascism, you have to realize that fascism is not only in Hitler, but in you yourself, because without fascist thinking of the whole people, of germs of fascism in thinking of, no, Hitler would have never become the Führer of Germany, yes? I know that such an idea is in a way very alien to American thinking, yes? Where all the time somebody is to blame, yes? Yes? So when nowadays Americans criticize poor idiot George Bush, my usual answer is, think first of your own common overall idiocy, without which no George Bush would have never become president. You understand that? That is, again, in a purely Buddhistic way, we have always to revert our argumentation from the outside, yes, to myself, yes, to my own thinking, yes. Again, let me make one, enough with the 20th century, yes. I do not like it, yes. It's very difficult to get rid of it, sir. Try to forget it. You are a young man. For you, it would be much easier than for me, yes. Simply do forget it. That's the shittiest century in the human history. Try to think about that. Let me return to old man Heraclitus with that everlasting question. Who cannot step twice in the same river? And you know, there is a very interesting in Heraclitus. By the way, who is your regular professor of the history of philosophy here?
Joe Cummins. For ancient?
No, for general history of philosophy.
All of them teach it.
Sorry?
All of them have to teach it in future. And we have...
In very few lectures.
They're non-historical.
Yeah, because what is particularly interesting that it was in that accursed 20th century, yes, that one other philosopher, as a person, of course, incomparable to Husserl and Camus, but quite a good philosopher. Well, yes, I do not like him as a person. But again, who cares? Yes, such opinions as I do not like something must be put within brackets, sir, you understand that? And you may immediately say, to hell with you, I like him. And no offense. It was Martin Heidegger. You heard of him? You definitely did, yes?
Yeah.
Who wrote a splendid piece of text on Heraclitean fragments. Because, you know, again, it is very interesting that, again, answering that question, who was, what was that which steps into the same river? Martin Heidegger discuss the problem that it is not necessarily man, but it may be a ghost, it may be spirit, yes, it may be even a dead person. It's very interesting because it simply shows that even in Heraclitus' mind, the idea of necessarily anthropocentrist interpretation was not yet deeply ingrained. Yes. Now, but again, one of the most distinctive features of that Buddhist principle of impermanence, yes, anicca in Sanskrit, that mark, that sign of the universe. The Buddhist principle of impermanence is based on the purely philosophical principle of what? We have already talked about that 2 weeks ago. Momentariness of all dharmas. They are momentary. By the way, now one little philosophical suggestion. When we are discussing the problem of stability or instability of something, of permanence or impermanence of something, to discuss that problem, we always have to postulate that there is enough, it is a difficult thing, there is enough time for one, yes, for somebody to observe what is going on, yes. Very interesting philosophical point. Because momentariness of any event, of any phenomenon, in the first place means what? that nobody has time to observe it. Because the time of observation will be, by definition, billions times longer than the time of the occurrence of that phenomenon or event. You understand that?
Let's say that we see something, let's say we observe something.
Oh no, again, well, I have already given you one very funny example. That still, however fantastic it might sound, but you can observe the flash of an electron due to the properties of what? Biochemical and biophysical properties of your eye and a visual nervous, central nervous mechanism. Nobody had believed it until one chap from Moscow, by mere chance, observed it. And lucky chap got Nobel Prize. Why? Because indeed there was a coincidence of what? Nervous impulse with the flashing of an electron. But there are billions of such coincidences. But in order to observe it, you have to what? To know about electron before. That is, it is not simply the time of perception. Because thousands of other persons may see it not knowing what, in fact, they see. That is why we read in the first chapter of the Buddhist book about Dharma, Dhamma Sangani, why it is written that there can be not a single, however small, perception, sensual perception, that is pertaining to one of the five or six, well, organs of senses, without thought accompanying. More than that. Louder, please.
Isn't the difference in the duration of the observation just one of the ways in which it's different than the...
You know, the thing is that there can be no such a smallest time of observation imaginable which you would be able to squeeze between two dharmas. Or at least, so the great Buddhist commentator and philosopher Buddha Ghosha wrote in his commentary, it is unimaginable. It is unimaginable. But, you know, that is why it is, shall we say, it is the one of the bases of this first idea and first mark, impermanence of everything, which follows from the momentariness of Dharma. But moreover, there is one other Buddhist idea at the basis of that first mark, yes, with which Edward Conze starts his third chapter for you to have it read. Yes. Okay, back. Now let us pass to two other marks of the universe. Eyelessness, egolessness as the second mark, you know. Which means, I think what I am going to tell you, it is a kind of additional interpretation. All of us, of course, including probably the greatest philosopher of the new European tradition. Who was the greatest philosopher of the new tradition? The first great philosopher.
What do you mean by the new tradition?
Oh, well, the start, according to our standard chronology, from the 17th century onward.
Rousseau?
Sorry?
Rousseau.
Who?
Jean-Jacques Rousseau.
Who? Rousseau? Oh God, Rousseau appeared much later. The first philosopher of the new, or they usually called it the tradition of European Enlightenment,
Descartes?
Was undoubtedly René Descartes. René Descartes. Well, Jean-Jacques Rousseau was a great man and great writer, undoubtedly, but no great philosopher. He would never agree with you calling him a philosopher. He hated all philosophers, yes. Poor Jean-Jacques Rousseau. But in a way, he was a splendid writer, a very interesting person. And his role in the development of Enlightenmental tradition in Europe is probably unmatched. Well, anyway, René Descartes, you read his Meditations, yes? Yes? Okay. You know, what is very interesting? His main formula is what?
Main
formula. Motto, slogan, as it were.
Oh, I think that's what I am.
Yes. I think, therefore, I exist. What here is very interesting, ladies and gentlemen, and it would help you to understand that second mark of Buddhism, that is egolessness. Which means that, first of all, I think. By the way, he never said, my I thinks, therefore it exists. No, he said I in an absolutely functional, linguistical sense, as a pronoun, yes, the first person, singular. He would never say, we think, therefore we exist. And you know, and it is both in his Meditations and on the Method. Yes, what is very, very interesting, speaking again about that Buddhist principle, the second mark, of principle of I-lessness. Of course, in as it were, anticipating some questions. Okay, you think, therefore you exist. But what about, what?
Skulls.
Oh, what about the past time? You thought, therefore you existed. It is a twist, it is a quirk. And very patiently, René Descartes answered that question himself, yes. No, it was in Meditation, undoubtedly. And he exactifies it in a very, by the way, strange way. I was existing, again, I. When I thought. I cannot say that it was a brilliant answer, yes, because it considerably changes the first formula. Now, because the first formula, I think therefore I exist, cogito ergo sum, absolute present in both French and Latin, yes, in both texts. You know that very soon he produced the second text in Latin again. Again, it is also to be even more exact. So, the first text, as you know, was in French. And because he wanted more people to read it in simple, absolutely transparently simple French, yes. Well, he was a bit too over-optimistic. Only 400 copies were sold. Anyway, what does it mean, egolessness? Add to what it is written in Konz's third chapter, I made copies for you. Do reread it again. It's a very good food for your thinking, yes. You never do let it starve your thinking without food, yes. And never poison it with bad food, with rotten food. Now, but egolessness is a very independent philosophical problem. Again, in that Descartes' formulation, I think, therefore, I exist. We have three philosophical notions. To wit, I, yes, then thinking, then existence. And the main difference between the Buddhist philosophy and Cartesian or Descartes' philosophy is that these three notions were interpreted differently in the Buddhist philosophy and in Descartes' meditations. Because for Descartes, yes, I and to exist, yes, in Latin, esse, yes, and to exist were what essential and Andrew inborn ideas. That is, you were born with these ideas. You understand that? It is not that you invented your idea of I, according to Descartes, and your idea of existence, or of to be, yes. It's a very interesting point. Because that, as a philosophical idea, again, it was in Descartes' philosophy that we see its appearance, inborn ideas. And again, why is that so with Descartes? For a very simple reason. Because Descartes considered himself a true what? What? A true, more than a Catholic. Christian it is well, too weak, yes. Catholic. And that is why he returns again and again to purely theological thought that when God created the man, he created the man, Adam, that is, with your kindest permission. He created the man with the capacity to know, with a sort of inbred talent for knowledge, yes. On that point, Paul René Descartes was definitely over-optimistic, yes. I disagree with him completely. But in absolutely direct disagreement with him, we are meeting with that idea of a Buddhist idea of ignorance as the initial and the first factor. Ignorance, because according to Descartes, initial factor was what? Knowledge. He was no Buddhist at all, my lady Descartes. So he was an absolute genius. Yes. By the way, in some of his, particularly his letters, we may see even some Buddhist motives and Buddhist developments. But the poor chap, he was a great philosopher, but probably he was a great philosopher, and he was a brave officer, yes, because he fought what? In the 30 years war, yes, in this, at the beginning of the 17th century, but you know that, yes, of course, from your course of history of philosophy here. But he was by no means a brave person, and he was very afraid of the secret spies of Inquisition, yes. At the time, Paris was swarming with them, yes. Particularly intellectual Paris, yes. It happens, yes, in various countries at various periods of time, yes. Now, the last remark about the principle of egolessness. That principle is exposed in the Buddhist philosophy. Try to remember it. Not necessarily only in its application to man. Dismiss your anthropocentrist attitude. All what I'm talking about is not about man. Forget about men, about women, yes, about snakes, no, elephants, yes, ghosts. By the way, I'm repeating Heraclitus, ghosts, yes. We are dealing with essentials of the great philosophy, which is not interested with such insignificant details as humankind, yes, insignificant. I needed only to give some examples for our understanding, yes, because unfortunately you and I, we are humans, yes. Normal, banal humans. In what way banal? Not striving for the highest truth and remembering only the trifling truths, yes. And that is why the idea of egolessness in its universal us means that there is no subjective conscious principle in the universe. There is consciousness without its absolute subject, be it a man or a woman, a snake, a god or goddess. This philosophy dismissed that purely authoritarian idea of some absolute I. Instead, it posited the totally other absolute idea of nirvana, where there is no ego, no I, because there is no consciousness. Because the idea of I can be thought about only in Buddhist philosophy, only in terms of consciousness. Because you use the word I, yes? Only because you are conscious of something, which is the subject of consciousness, then you, yes? And using your name, John, I am John. I am John. I am Mary, yes? I am the great snake of the northern Terai region between India and Nepal now, yes. That is, I is necessary for an ordinary thinking to use it as a kind of conventional subject of your consciousness and thinking. Though, as you undoubtedly have already observed, that some politicians like, instead of I, like using what? What?
We.
We and people, yes. when somebody is referring to people, it is the first symptom that somebody is going to lie about something. Yes. Yes. So the first stage of lying is we instead of I. The second stage of deception is as used, you remember there was such an outstanding Prime Minister of United Kingdom as Mrs. Thatcher, yes. No, you are too young.
Yeah, I remember.
Yes. And she always, instead of I and we, used what? Somebody thinks, or one is inclined to think, etc. Well, it is a device, yes, used by quite a few liars too. But the limit of deception, of course, is people. Yes, people think, yes. Sometimes instead of people, well, what? Instead of people, yes, a figure, well, something like majority in, or all of us, yes.
You know what they say.
Sorry?
You know what they say.
Yes, you know what they say. Yes, you know what they say. It is very, but ladies and gentlemen, I'm not joking. It is very serious because you cannot appreciate to what extent your language to which you pay no attention influences your own thinking. You understand that?
That's what
the first step in one's becoming a philosopher, my friend, is what I said now. What did I say now? Let us check it, let us control it. Yes? Why did I use this word instead of that? It's the first, not only in Buddhism, there are some other philosophies where it is the first recommendation. Doubt your words. Check your words in order to diminish their influence. And finally, we are coming to the third mark again, suffering. Because suffering does not necessarily presuppose the existence of the subject of consciousness. It is consciousness where suffering can be reflected. Because without, we may put it even a bit differently, without individual consciousness, there can be no suffering. And that is why it is said that in Nirvana there is no individual consciousness. So that is, what is that which suffers then? And there can be no suffering. It's ridiculous, it's nonsense. In the absence of a that which suffers, yes. Then it is a pure, fruitless speculation. And that is why there is no suffering in Nirvana. And now, let us return. We still have, how many minutes? Five?
We're 5 minutes over.
Sorry?
We've gone 5 minutes too long.
Yes. But, well, it is 1 minute. 1 minute. I hate these restrictions in time. Yeah. But, you know, while returning to that our ineradicable, yes, incurable intellectual attitude of anthropocentrism, you may ask me, and at the same time the late Professor Edward Conze, what then can be instead of anthropocentrism as the main direction of our thinking? And the answer is direction towards the absolute, a reorientation of our thinking from man to a certain absolute, which is different in different philosophies. In Buddhism, one of the terms for absolute is that which is absolutely unconditioned by any factors, that is Nirvana. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for your almost enlightened attention. Let me remind you that tomorrow I will be, as always, available in my room between 11 and 1.
You read my paper, Professor?
Yes, and I all your papers will be absolutely welcoming. And next week you will be given new titles for new papers. And try your best to do something in life, I mean. But first of all, far more important than to do something, what? To think all the time. And doesn't matter essentially what about them.
And last week, Professor.
I did a lot of thinking, but this is anything else that I put felt like.
So you will come tomorrow, yes? Or if you have time, yes, between 11 and 1.
And this is the start of a paper at least.
Sorry?
And this is the start of a paper at least?
Yes.
Or?
Good. You want me to take it now?
Yeah.
For my orientation before you come, yes?
Yeah.
Good.
PhD.
Sorry?
PhD.
What is that? Oh, no. Of course I heard. But honestly, never read it. Yes. My brother. Follow. Позвони, пожалуйста.